Okay, the meeting will come to order, and we've got three bills up, so we're going to do them in this order, and if you've been in this committee before, we have certain time limits on them. So the first bill will be Representative Winkler's, and that should take 5 to maximum 10 minutes. And within these time periods, if there's any amendments, let me know first so that we can make sure we get to them. The second bill will be mine, that'll be 25 minutes, and the third will be Representative Simon's, and that'll be 55. And so, Representative Winkler, just go ahead and... Oh, wait, you're not on the committee. Would somebody like to move his bill?
Mr. Chair, I'll move House File...
Representative Feldstrom.
I'll move House File 100, and where does it need to go, Mr. Chair?
It goes to General Register, I believe.
Okay, I would move House File 100 to the General Register.
Representative Winkler, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Hillstrom. This bill is a, I would characterize a technical cleanup bill from the 35W Bridge Compensation Bill that we passed last session. The bill really addresses some of the concerns raised by the special master panel that was created, and is, I think, fairly limited in its both controversy and its reach. Section 1 deals with panel members' records that they keep as they are hearing claims, and makes clear basically that they cannot be discovered or introduced in evidence in a subsequent proceeding, much like settlement negotiations are not used in future proceedings that are not discoverable. Subdivision 6 of Section 1 makes clear that those panel members are considered employees of the state for purposes of indemnification. Again, they don't want to be exposed to legal liability for performing the tasks that we assign to them. And then finally, Section 4 essentially just clarifies the extent of the subrogation waiver that certain third-party interests have to sign pursuant to the legislation. And I don't know if you have a strict 24-hour rule, Mr. Chair, but I have a one-word addition that I'd like to add to the amendment, or to the bill, if that would be acceptable.
Representative Winkler, we don't have a strict 24-hour
rule. Okay.
So go ahead. Somebody else, you read it, and then I'll have Representative Health from a moment.
Okay. On line 2.23, in the middle of the line, after the word claims, the underlying word claims, I would insert the word, such, the word such, S-U-C-H, after the word claims. So it would read, and who claims such a subrogation or other interest?
Representative Feldstrom moves the word such on line 2.23 after the word claims. That's to put it in the shape that the author wants it. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Okay. Go ahead, Representative Winkler.
And Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to take questions. I have with me Al Gilbert, the Solicitor General from the Attorney General's Office, to help answer any questions of a more technical nature, or any other questions I guess you'd like to put to him. But aside from that, that's what the bill does. It's a relatively small cleanup, I think, for the bill that we passed last year.
Representative Winkler, yes, I also talked to Representative Latz, who wasn't in complete agreement with you on everything last year, but he's in complete agreement on this bill. So is there any... Representative Holbert?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Winkler, you're probably not surprised I still have concerns with this, and I'm just going to state them again. From the record, I don't think there's enough sunshine here. Just the settlement agreement, this is a lot of money. There's no ability for the public to see the rationale for the determination of the amounts, any justification as far as expenditures, what the exact expenses were. I mean, I'm not asking to look at medical records, et cetera, but only the terms of the settlement. That's the total end game, and we're just supposed to blindly accept that it was a fair process and everybody, got their due, if you will, and the money was appropriated in a fair and reasonable manner. And I think that there should be more information available to the taxpayers. There was great interest in this issue, concern, and you know, what happens if we get to the end and half of the people aren't happy and others are, and there's no ability for anybody to figure out if something went wrong, if it did, how. You know, I just think that there's just way too much hidden information, and I hope that, you know, I don't know if this is a done deal or whatever, but I think that the taxpayers of Minnesota deserve more information to provide the justification for the settlement amount.
Well, Representative Holberg, I think not everybody here, including me, was perfectly happy with the bill that went through last year, but that's done. This is a little correction of a couple of things.
Well, and Mr. Chair, to that point, on the House floor, when the bill left the floor, Representative Winkler made the assurances to the body that he would work on this issue. And when it got back at a conference committee, it actually went the opposite direction. And he and I had another conversation about this particular issue. And he, again, you know, he was frustrated, recognizing you have to work with the Senate as well. But I don't know that he totally disagrees with my points either. And I just, you know, I'm stating for the record that the public deserves to know more in how this money is distributed and spent.
And that may be a subject of a different bill, but this is an extremely narrow bill.
Well, Mr. Chair, this bill governs the distribution of that money, and it's my points are directly to this particular issue, so I don't know why it would be a different bill.
Mr. Chair, if I could give I know this won't satisfy Representative Holberg, but at least it might provide some rationale. I think another way to think of this process is a structured settlement between these individuals in the state of Minnesota. And typically, when you have a settlement negotiation type process, that information is not available for future legal proceedings because you want to give people a reason to give their best case and be honest about the settlement value of their case and have the other side be able to engage in those open negotiations knowing that it won't be used against them sometime down the line. And while I think this bill will preclude most, if not all, litigation against the state of Minnesota, there are other interests that will be involved in litigation. And I think it makes it hard for plaintiffs and the state of Minnesota to engage in that kind of open discussion of claims and harms without it prejudicing future litigation. So there is, at least in the legal world, it's kind of, there's a precedent for this. And then the only other thing I can, I guess, throw to you is that we do intend to have hearings this legislative session on the process and how it works and hear from both claimants and from the special master panel about how the process works. It won't get into details of individual cases and medical records and extended injury and so on, but we will have some hearings on how the process works. And finally, I would say that I have personally heard from both the special master panel as well as survivors and their attorneys about the process, and everybody so far is very satisfied with the way this has progressed. And I would be surprised if any of these potential claimants didn't choose to go through this route in the end.
And Mr. Chair, I understand that, but I'm trying to also represent the taxpayers of Minnesota that are paying for this.
I understand.
And, you know, maybe there's an ability for the special masters to provide a summary report with some of the rationale or, you know, in broad terms, talk about things that they covered and reimbursed, things that they didn't. You know, I mean, there's got to be more information for the public. Or maybe there's a time period when a certain information would become public when you feel that it's all other lawsuits related to this would be completed and those the disclosure of that information wouldn't jeopardize the integrity of any future lawsuits, a 10-year, you know, open a window type of thing. Or, I mean, there are some options here to provide more sunshine into the expenditure of a whole lot of money.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, I think that the summary information idea this session might be a possibility, and we'll ask the panel if they can put together something that is both respects confidentiality and does provide a bit more information to the public.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any other comments before we vote? Okay, then all of the Representative Hillstrom renews her motion to send House pass and refer to the General Register, House File Number 100, as amended. All in favor, say aye.
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 All opposed, no.
No.
Carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Let's see. Representative Mahoney moves the minutes of the January 12th meeting. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carry. Representative Johnson, would you? Welcome, Representative. Would you like to move your bill?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll move House File Number 90, and I believe it has to go to Commerce. They've requested it.
Very good. Representative Mulray moves House File Number 90 to Commerce Committee. Go ahead and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I realized about 2 months ago how archaic we are in some ways about the treatment of renters in this state. I was at a meeting, community meeting. Afterwards, there were people talking that weren't happy with some of the election results, and several of them said that the problem was that people that didn't pay property tax were allowed to vote. And I'm thinking of what that meant from the South. That used to happen in the South. And yet I'm hearing it here in Minnesota, and this was despite the fact that I pointed out to them they paid income tax, sales tax, and indirectly they paid property tax, but not directly, because they were renters. And I guess there's a lot of ways that we don't respect renters in this state, and I think that the treatment of renters on exemptions from creditors is a typical example. Two-thirds of the states in this country have a general exemption. It's labeled different ways, but I think a general exemption is typical. Around us, North Dakota, South Dakota, Iowa, Illinois, Missouri, and in similar states, Ohio, Maryland, Connecticut, Maine, Virginia, Washington, Vermont, North Carolina, even Texas and almost all of the South have a general exemption. And what that means is, and the difference is, the way this is so incredibly unfair to people is a person who owns a home can shelter $300,000 in the home. If they have an auto on top of it, another $4,200. If they have fancy furnishings, $8,500. Life insurance, $4,000. Pension, I believe, is $30,000. So they can shelter about $360,000. And the little guy who's a renter can't even have $2,000 in an account that he's saved up. In fact, he can only have, I believe it's 20 days after his earnings are earned before creditors can go after it. So we really are not at all being fair to people in those situations. I think it's about time that we get into the modern world and start treating people equally, even if they're renters. And so what this would do would be it would provide an exemption of $10,000 in property for people that are in those types of situations. It would be a general exemption of $10,000. And basically, that's the whole bill, is just to try and get some equity into this situation. I do have Mr. Lundquist here, an attorney who handles both bankruptcy and claims of creditors. Do you want to just explain a little bit about this?
Sure. Welcome, Mr. Lunches. Would you just state your name and, for the record, who you are?
Sure, thank you. My name is Ronald Lundquist. I'm an attorney in Eagan, Minnesota. I've been working in the debtor-creditor field for almost 10 years now. And what Mr. Miller is talking about is the exemptions and the role that they play in the debtor-creditor relationship. And as he mentioned, there's a glaring deficit in Minnesota law in that, I mean, he's outlined, you know, the important exemptions that exist for people that have money. But the lack of what we call a general exemption or a wild card exemption, which where a debtor can protect anything, any property of any sort whatsoever, is a glaring deficit in Minnesota law. And this happens to renters, people that are not property owners. It happens to people that happen to, you know, maybe default on a rent or a credit card or something like that. A creditor gets a judgment against them. Maybe we'll garnish them, but what often happens is they may seize a bank account. This happens with many retired people on Social Security. You know, all of a sudden they wake up in the morning, their $800 in the bank is gone, and there's no Minnesota law to protect or to prevent that from happening against them. Now, the law, in the example of Social Security, the law would allow a debtor to go into court and show that this is from an exempt source, but it's on the debtor to do that. So it's not automatic on that person's part. In my work, I have an example of a client that I had, a bankruptcy client that, this was a woman that worked in Minneapolis. She had her own salon, which had four chairs. And I think there's some documents that maybe can be handed out to kind of explain what happened to her. In her case, she,
can go ahead and talk.
Sure. In her case, she was forced to use the Minnesota state exemptions as far as protecting her property. Her case was filed in late 2006, and the use of these exemptions prevented the, since there's no wild card exemption in Minnesota, basically what she had, an asset that she had that could not be protected was an income tax return of about $4,000. And just going to the papers being handed out now just kind of, you know, show what happened. I tried to get her to come here today, except that her phone's been disconnected. I can't reach her in any way. But Schedule A shows her real estate. Schedule B shows all of her other personal property, and I've excised the identifying information for this person. Schedule C shows what she's been able to exempt, again, showing that there's no wild card exemption. Schedule G just documents that this was a self-employed person that had employees, so she was a job creator in our community. And what happened was she was aware that she was required to pay over to the trustee. And when you file bankruptcy, your lawyers call trustees who work for the government. They administer the estate. They collect assets that are not protected. And she was aware that this was something that should have been paid over to the trustee, and the trustee demanded it from her. She told me she couldn't pay it over. She needed to keep the money to keep her business going, and that's what she did. The trustee, I mean, very good trustee, just did his job, which was to go into bankruptcy court and have her discharge revoked, so she's no longer protected from her creditors, as well as get a judgment against her for the about $3,500 that she was not able to pay over to the trustee. So this is an example of, you know, someone that was damaged because of a lack of a Minnesota wild card exemption, and even a modest exemption would have protected this, you know, relatively small tax refund from the trustee and maybe kept her business operating and kept her going. I guess to sum up, the role of exemptions in Minnesota is found in the Constitution, Article 1, Section 12, stating that a reasonable amount of property shall be exempt from seizure or sale for the payment of any debt or liability. The amount of such exemption shall be determined by law. So I think with this bill is Representative Mueller is trying to effectuate the intent of the Constitution in the changing, in terms of changing property that citizens of Minnesota have. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr.
Pastor. Mr. Lundquist. Members, questions? Representative Holman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Mueller, you listed off a whole bunch of states. Are they all at 10,000? Are they at differing amounts? Is this?
I think they range from 5,000 to 50,000, I believe, something like that.
My research shows from 5 to about 25,000.
I think there's one that's higher, way up. I can't remember which one.
And
Representative Holbrook,
if I might, just to clarify, it's a total of 10,000. So if you had, right before you did this, you ran out and ran up two or three credit cards at buying stuff, personal property, $20,000 worth, you could only shield half of that. Is that correct?
Right.
Representative Drusowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Mulley, is the term equity interest defined anywhere in Minnesota law?
Equity interest?
It says in the bill that...
Drusowski?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Line 1.8 says the debtor's equity interest. Does that term have meaning in law?
Representative Mulley?
Mr. Chairman, I don't know if it's specifically defined. I think any attorney would know what it is. Maybe Mr. Lundquist.
I don't know if it's specifically defined.
Mr. Lundquist?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know if it's specifically defined. I would be concerned that might be too limiting. I mean, perhaps it should read any property of any type. There may be cases out there that restrict the term equity, and I'm just simply not aware of whether that's the case. I do suppose I've seen the bill this morning. But I think that may be an issue as far as maybe being too limiting.
Follow up, Representative Drusowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Mulley, how would this affect small claims judgments of $10,000 or less?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mulley, it would be exempt from that because other exemptions are.
May I respond to that question?
Mr. Lundquist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When a judgment is rendered in small claims court, oftentimes the creditor will send to the debtor what are called post-judgment interrogatories, where the debtor is required to reveal assets that the debtor has. It's based on that disclosure that a debtor would claim an exemption. And it's very possible debtors would have something that's not exempt. I mean, something that would exceed the $10,000 or a different category of property.
Representative Pena, you've been waiting.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Miller, I'm just confused about the exemptions under 550.337R. I'm just looking at the bill summary. Are those exemptions currently in state law? Are the exemptions that are listed in the bill summary currently in state law, or is that what you're adding?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Paymer, the specified exemptions in the bill summary are already
in
state law. It's about a 3-page statute, and they all have different exemptions, and I went over some of them. There's also a Bible. There's different things.
And so what, Mr. Chair, what additional exemptions would be included in your bill?
Basically, it would be a $10,000 exemption, because there's a lot that isn't here, and what I'm thinking mostly it would be people have bank accounts, and I believe under, and I can't remember the subdivision number, but for instance, your earnings after 20 days in a financial institution are subject to levy, for instance. Or if you get a present from your dad, or you inherit $5,000 or $2,000 from your family, that would be subject immediately.
That would be $10,000 in addition to the specified exemptions in currently in the statute.
Yes, I'm sorry.
Okay, Mulley.
Representative Maria.
Thank you.
Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Mulley, I have a major concern that we're moving certainly away from personal responsibility, and in the situation we're in right now, we've got to lead by example and show responsibility. But my question is a follow-up to Representative Drusowski's. When you're talking about the small claims court, so if we get a judgment, it's my understanding that if it was $14,000 this judgment, that automatically $10,000 would be exempt?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kelly, no, not automatically. It would, as Mr. Lundquist said, it depends on what type of property you have.
Members, we also have some testimony audience. I believe if you wouldn't mind, we'll just take a couple minutes to take that testimony and allow for further questions after that time. Mr. Lundquist?
May I clarify, Mr. Chair, on the question? The exemption would not automatically make $10,000 worth of judgment not valid. It simply means that, I mean, the whole $14,000 example of the judgment would still be valid. If a debtor had, say, you know, $50,000 of unexempt assets somewhere, they could still execute on the judgment fully.
Thank
you. Well, Mr. Chair, if I can just clarify, in that case,
Term, Holbrook,
if they had $50,000 worth of assets, only $40,000 would be available under your scenario. I mean, the way I'm looking at this is, it's like $10,000 of whatever, basically. And Representative Mulery, I don't understand in your example of having money in the bank. If you have money in the bank, shouldn't you be paying your creditors?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think the answer, according to the people who wrote our Constitution, was that we should have exemptions, and we provide huge exemptions for those of us who have houses and things like that. We provide nothing to little guys like renters. I think that's just outrageous.
Well, Mr. Chair, then maybe the bill should be structured for some kind of other situation. You've just given $10,000 to the big guys, the little guys, everybody, just no matter what.
Well, Mr. Chair, and Representative Holberg, the big guys already have plenty of exemptions.
Got a question over here by Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and this would be for Mr. Lundquist or Representative Mulery. So if you're making a $10,000 exemption for a renter, say a college student, middle-aged, you know, fella, whatever, so you've got typical rents somewhere between $1,000 and $1,500, a car is probably about $5,000, so there you got $6,500, and if you've got to change apartments, you've got a $1,500 first month's rent, $1,500 damage deposit, and $1,500 in rent for the next apartment. Already, if you got $10,000 in the bank, or you're exempting $10,000, you're already above that $10,000. So what you're really trying to do is allow someone to basically start over. And that's not an... It's not an irresponsible issue of not allowing, not paying your debts. It's the responsibility of getting somebody, keeping somebody basically off the street and saying, get your life back in order. And as a homeowner, as I understand it, I can exempt about $350,000 or better, without any, just off the top of my head. So we're giving somebody, giving a homeowner 35 times what we give a renter in this bill.
Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Mullins,
Representative Mahoney, yes.
In fact,
I just wanted that clarification. Thank you.
All right, members, we're going to hold off on further questions, get a chance for folks to testify who might be in opposition or have comments from the public. So at this time, I don't have specific names, but see if someone wants to testify from the audience. Welcome. If you'd have a seat and say your name for the record, who you represent or who you are.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Alan Zeman. I'm an attorney practicing law primarily in creditors' rights for about 40 years now.
And just one comment. What was the last name again?
Zlimen.
And we have about 2 minutes to test.
Okay, very quickly. First, I've written books. I've rewritten statutes dealing with exemptions, creditors' rights, and the rest of, and other related matters. Very quickly, when I first looked at this bill, my reaction was literally one of shock and dismay because this is the single biggest change in the history of Minnesota in creditors' rights. There are many unintended consequences with this bill. I'm particularly distressed that we're taking a part of a very complex statute with exemptions, and taking only that portion and not taking the rest of the exemption act and making them so that we have a workable system. Mention was made of the homestead exemptions in other states. Of those states that Representative Mulery mentioned, whether it's New York, New Jersey, Wisconsin,
Illinois, Michigan, Ohio, the state of Washington, the state of Colorado. Many of those states only have a $5,000 homestead exemption, $5,000 to $40,000 in every case, whereas we have over 300. More importantly, and very quickly, I'm rushing through this because time is short, but this bill has some flaws that have to be rectified before it goes anywhere. In a normal exemption case, there is a procedure for the debtor to claim the exemption. There are forms established, there are court hearings and proceedings which must be laid out, much as we have with wage garnishment exemption and other things of that nature. There are ambiguities with the bill. The research memo that came with it differs from the content of the bill, at least insofar as I read it. The question is, if I sue someone such as yourself, Mr. Chairman, for example, purposes, and I have a conciliation court judgment because you smashed my car, or perhaps you're a bad guy and you defrauded me. I sue you. If you have only a $10,000 bank account somewhere, I cannot levy on that make myself whole again under the bill. But more questions arise. What if it's a Visa credit card bill? If I sue you and you have a CD and a bank account, are they both exempt? If she then sues you, can you claim the exemption for either or both of those assets, or how does that relate back to the asset that I am trying to collect, and how does it relate to the exemption? And again, how is the exemption claimed? So very quickly, there are problems with the bill. It shouldn't be dealt with piecemeal. By the way, coincidentally, we have a committee of lawyers which has redrafted previous statutes dealing with garnishment and levy. We've been looking at exemptions. We're dealing with revising the forms. We're working with the Legal Aid Society. And my suggestion would be that this matter be tabled, and in the next session we come back with a new exemption statute which will have proper forms, proper notices, and if this body then decides to change the dollar amounts, it can certainly do so in the context of the statute as a whole. Last but not least, I'm distressed again because much of the conversation I heard this morning deals with bankruptcy. If you're having this bill apply to the bankrupt, that's different than ordinary creditors' rights. So again, we've got to look at what the purpose of the bill is and see how it meshes with the rest of the statute before we just go and pass the bill.
All right. Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Zwieman. And would you like to proceed with your testimony? Identify yourself for the record, please. And
my name is Heidi Stalo, S-T-A-L-O-C-H. And I am also an attorney practicing in the area of creditors' rights since 1996. Mr. Chair?
Please proceed.
I'm very concerned about the impact of this proposed amendment. It unilaterally determines funds beyond the state of exemptions are warranted in all cases, not in some cases, in every case, whether they be a renter or a homeowner. It debilitates a creditor's legal right to collect judgments under Chapters 570 and 571. It enables financial carelessness by giving a wild card, a $10,000 wild card exemption, when especially in these tough economic times, we need to be focused on promoting financial responsibility. Lastly, it invites unnecessary litigation by its broad language and broad impact on judgment creditors' ability to collect for their clients. As a person, practitioner, mentor, and constituent, I believe in balanced rights. In this finite realm of exemptions, I believe fundamental pieces must remain exempt. I believe that a debtor who is amidst times of hardship, the one like Mr. Lundquist described, needs some breathing room and time to recover. I do not believe, however, that a judgment debtor who has a good job, owns a home, has $8,000 sitting in his bank account, should be rewarded with a post-judgment $10,000 wild card exemption. Creditors have the right to collect from those that are able to pay. The proposed amendment unilaterally determines that all judgment debtors are in the same financial situation. With this amendment, a person making the $300,000 salary could easily avoid payment of judgments by strategically managing finances. The style of this amendment is putting all sorts of shapes into the round hole. Some fit, others do not. It needs more clarity. It will also greatly impact the budget of an already constrained court system. It will result for our firm over $3 million of filing fees not paid into the court each year, as judgments provide our clients with nothing more than the ability to call and collect. As an overall average collection for us on post-judgment files is $322. So even a $1,000 wildcard exemption applied after all of the other exemptions that our state has specified and other states do not, that would have the same result. Further, the amendment in effect renders the ancient wage garnishment statutes meaningless, as most judgments are for less than a wild card exemption. In 2008, our firm entered more than 14,000 judgments. Only 16% exceeded the $10,000 mark. The average balance was $7,000. Of all of the garnishments that we issued on the bank accounts, less than 1% hit more than this $10,000 wild card exemption. It's hard work to agree on particularity in these statutes. As Mr. Lehman indicated, we've been working for years and years trying to modify this and balance those rights of creditors and debtors. The exemptions set forth in 550.37 address these with particularity and provide expansive breathing room for those requiring relief based on need. Renters get all of the exemptions except the homestead exemption, which is limited to $300,000. The rest of it applies to a renter just as it does to anyone else. The proposed amendment before you invites litigation over both definition, the question that was asked here, what is a debtor's equity interest, as well as application. How does one claim that exemption? How are we going to make this happen? How do I prove that? How, you know, what is the court going to do to make that determination? I urge you to get additional input from those of us who use the statute day in and day out, the ones that are using it in the court system from both the creditor side as well as the debtor side. Shake hands across the table. That's what we're trying to do in our committee, is trying to find that common ground and work hard to develop balance rights for both the creditors and the debtors. Thank you.
Thanks for your testimony, Ms. Stalo. Representative Westrom, question?
Two questions, Mr. Chair. One for the first gentleman, then for the second testifier. You talked about bankruptcy. And is maybe one of your thoughts that this could be, this should maybe be looked at closer for bankruptcy, but not just a broad net for anybody that owes a debt? Or can you just expand on that a little more?
Mr. Zeman?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Representative, the Bankruptcy Act deals specifically with homestead exemptions and the so-called wild card exemption in those cases where an individual does not own a home. Under the state statute, there's got to be an integration process between the two. The examples that we heard mentioned this morning were almost all entirely bankruptcy related. As Ms. Dallas just pointed out, there are many situations where there is no bankruptcy involved, where there are assets involved, where the debtor does have accounts, he is able to pay, and he does not do so. So the exemption, as it applies, has to vary between the situations.
Representative Westrom, members, just a heads up, we do need to move this bill within the next 5 minutes or so, so we'll try to take care of questions, give the opportunity for Representative Mulway to come back up and answer questions or continue with what he has to say. But with that, go to Representative Westrom follow-up.
Mr. Chair, we also can vote the bill down. That's another option the committee has, isn't it?
Certainly, Representative Westrom. Proceed with your question,
okay.
Please.
Mr. Chair, for the second witness, Heidi, now I forgot my question. You were talking about, I don't know how many, 14,000 creditors that you file claims for. Can you tell me what, I mean, who are these creditors? I mean, is it Target Corporation? Is it 3M? I mean, are you just talking to big companies? Are you talking mom and pop shops that run small businesses? Are you talking individuals that have some sideline investments in rental property? I mean, who are you representing in those 14,000 people? Who are you saying this would apply to? Is it just the big companies? Is that what we're looking at here?
Mr. Chair, Representative, we entered 14,000 judgments, so it's not 14,000 creditors. So to clarify that point, our clients range from businesses who have one person, you know, a sole proprietor, no employees, to the Capital Ones of the world. So it's a variety that hits on that, and it crosses the spectrum. The volume would be leaning towards more of a traditional credit card, variety of credit cards, because that's the volume in of debt that in our world. But that is not our firm represents from small businesses all the way up to the big guy banks.
Thanks. Tim Campion. Here's my question. Is your opposition to this particular bill specifically related to the fact that it provides a general exception or a general exemption and not necessarily a specific exemption to renters only?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Campion, no. That is another ambiguity. I am frankly more concerned with the lack of a mechanism within this bill. We don't know how it works. We don't know how even whether you're a renter or a homeowner, how you would claim that exemption. What is the procedure? What's the court's role in this? There has to be a judicial oversight. So we have all these other questions that go in to the makeup of the bill, along with the ambiguities as to exactly what is this property. So there are a number of things that go in, but right now it's quite cloudy, and there's an enormous amount of clarification that has to be done in numerous areas.
Representative Dzikowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Zleeman and Ms. Dello, thank you. Would you characterize, I mean, if this bill would become law, would you expect an increase or a decrease in the defaults on contractual obligations? Would you expect more people to be going further into debt, or would you expect it to improve the situation?
Mr. Zimmerman, Representative Dzikowski, let me give a 10-second preamble. You know, there is what we have, a debtor community in the world. Back when I was doing research for one of my books, I realized that roughly 15% of the people don't pay bills. 7.5 to 8% of those are because they're temporarily ill, divorced, drug or alcohol problems, or other what I would call temporary setbacks. But there's another category of people out there, roughly 7%, that don't like to pay bills. I had divorce clients who were spendthrifts, they had no priorities. There are whole families where you look at the file and grandpa didn't pay the bills, the uncles don't pay the bills, dad didn't pay the bills, and the kids don't. It's their culture. Those people are going to utilize this to their fullest advantage. So in that respect, there will be some more defaults. It's going to happen because there are people that know how to take advantage of these things. And it's another reason why we need some clarity and delineation in what is an asset that's protected and under what circumstances.
Jim, thank you for your testimony.
Mr. Chair, Mr.
Muller, would you like to resume at the desk there? Thank you for your testimony.
Excuse me, Mr.
Dzikowski, Representative Dzikowski.
Mr. Chair, I also ask Ms. Stella, too, could we hear from her on that question?
Certainly.
Thanks.
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to, because of the time we have, Simonsville, I had no idea that there seems to be, I don't understand what's going on here, but I'll ask to lay this over because we have to do Simonsville today. And so I just ask the chair to lay over this.
Very good. The bill will be laid over for the request of Representative Mulray.
Okay, Representative Simon, does somebody want to represent Goldstrom? Do you want to move this bill?
Certainly. Representative Simon, where does it need to go?
To the Commerce Committee.
I would move.
Representative Goldstrom moves
House File 8 to the Commerce Committee.
House File 8 for passage and reference to the Commerce Committee. Representative Simon, go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Mulder. It's good to be back. I missed the committee. members, as you know, I'm sure, defrauding the taxpayers, knowingly defrauding the taxpayers, is always bad. But it's even worse during a terrible economic time like this for our constituents and for our state. This year, we can do something about that. We can do something about those who knowingly, and that's the key word, knowingly defraud the state of Minnesota and our constituents by passing a False Claims Act.
And I'm just setting times.
Yes.
Is 10 minutes okay for your presentation?
It should be about right.
Okay, and then we'll have 10 minutes to the contrary, and then we'll set a limit of 20 minutes because we are going to get this to allow us, and we're not going to have what happened before.
Okay, thanks.
Okay.
This is the False Claims Act. It's House File 8. It's got 35 authors in the House, including many on this committee. The original False Claims Act was known as Lincoln's Law because it was enacted during the Civil War as a way for the federal government to get at crooked contractors who sold rotten food and bad mules to the Union Army. It's since expanded, and more than 100 years later, Congress made it clear that whistleblower employees can bring claims directly on behalf of the federal government if they are the original source of information about their employers knowingly, and that is the key word here, knowingly defrauding the taxpayers. And so those who uncover that misconduct are entitled to a percentage of the ultimate judgment or settlement. So it incentivizes whistleblowers who know about knowing, that is, those who knowingly defraud the government. And the wrongdoer is liable for up to 3 times the government's actual damages. Now, as a result, the federal government has recovered $22 billion. That's $22 billion in knowing fraud since 1986. But the federal law, of course, only applies to fraud upon the federal government. Knowing fraud upon the federal government doesn't get at fraud against state governments. So, in the interim, in the past 20 years, 21 states have enacted their own False Claims Act. And they, too, apply to contractors of any kind who knowingly scam the system, who knowingly defraud us and our constituents. And these include examples, for example, of contractors who double bill, who underpay, who charge for undelivered goods or services, who create phantom employees, doctored timesheets, and with the help of honest whistleblowing employees, they've been able to report knowing fraud, and states have therefore recovered hundreds of millions of dollars that would never have been discovered, never have been obtainable, that go directly to the taxpayers. Now, the various state laws have been particularly successful at rooting out fraud in programs like Medicaid that are jointly administered by the federal and state government. As many of you know, Medicaid in Minnesota is a 50-50 split, 50% feds, 50% state. And so, just on that basis alone, Illinois in the last year recovered $40 million from a health care plan that had cheated the state knowingly by accepting government payments for Medicaid patients that it never enrolled. It claimed these people were enrolled, took the reimbursement, and they knew that those people were never enrolled. $40 million settlement. Texas recovered $64 million in the last 4 years from 4 pharmaceutical companies that had, again, knowingly defrauded the taxpayers. We're not talking about accident, negligence, inadvertence. All of those are red herring arguments, and I suspect, unfortunately, you're going to hear some of those today. It's only knowing fraud. So because of the successes of these laws at the state level, Congress did something really extraordinary in 2006. And by the way, it was Senator Chuck Grassley, a Republican of Iowa, lest you think this is a partisan initiative. George W. Bush signed this law and enacted this in Texas. He signed the law. Former Senator and Attorney General John Ashcroft was always a big champion of the False Claims Act. So this is a bipartisan initiative across the country. And because of these laws at the state level, well, here's what Congress did in 2006. It said, look, states, this has been an effective law. If you pass a False Claims Act, just the mere act of passing it, even if it sits on a shelf and never gets used, passing a False Claims Act, here's what we're going to do. We're going to give you a 10% bonus on all your Medicaid fraud recoveries. So, for example, in Minnesota, as I mentioned, and as many of you know, it's a 50-50 split. So let's say we get $10 million in a Medicaid fraud recovery against some vendor who's knowingly cheating us. Right now, that would be split $5 million and $5 million. If we pass this law, simply passing the law, never using it, we get a 10% bump. So from now on, that would be $6 million to $4 million, a 60-40 split. That's how much faith and confidence Congress on a bipartisan basis has had in the ability of these laws to net real money for states and to really get out wrongdoers. Again, those who are knowingly defrauding the state. And so the Minnesota False Claims Act would, predictably, provide financial incentives, the same ones, to whistleblowers whose employers knowingly defraud our state government. And like the federal law, Minnesota's False Claims Act would allow whistleblowers to bring claims on behalf of the government. The Attorney General's office would then have the option to intervene in that case, basically take over the case from the individual plaintiff who comes forward. And in any case, if there's a successful judgment or if there's a settlement, that whistleblower would be entitled to a share of the ultimate settlement or recovery, and the state would be entitled to an amount up to 3 times the amount of its provable damages. Now, three things before I turn it over to, I think, what you'll find a compelling testifier. I want to preempt some of the stuff you're going to hear, not only today, but if we get out of this committee in days and weeks to come. And pun intended, some of them are false claims. First, you're going to hear that, well, you know, this is going to decimate nursing homes and the pillars of your community and others, because innocent, simple mistakes are going to be punished. Someone missed bills, or, you know, Joe or Billy in the back room are typing in the wrong billing code, and suddenly their employer, a very important employer, is on the hook. That is not true. That, too, is, in a way, a false claim. This law only applies to those who knowingly defraud, and the standard is set forth in quite a bit of detail in the statute. So, you know, the idea of nuisance lawsuits by greedy insiders is really, frankly, not true. And it also makes clear that the allowable claims are only those where the whistleblower is the original source. So if someone can't read about a problem in the newspaper, or watch it in the TV news, or hear about it at the water cooler, this person has to be the original source. They have to have insider knowledge. They can't have learned it from any other proceeding, administrative, criminal, or civil. They've got to be the original source. False claim number two that I think you're going to hear today and at other times is that current laws are enough. Hey, we've already got laws on the books that already get to the problem. What are you doing just piling on? Well, what they will intentionally, knowingly, if you will, obscure is that, yes, it's true, of course, we have anti-fraud laws on the books, but those don't go far enough, and for these reasons. Some only address Medicaid fraud. They don't have to do with the road contractor or the computer contractor or the school lunch contractor or others who knowingly defraud the state. Second, some only apply to successful fraud when we actually have been duped, not just the submission of a false claim. This bill does. And none of those laws on the books, none of them right now, allow incentives for a whistleblower who can stand in the shoes of the government. None of them do that. And none of them provide those financial incentives to root out fraud. And none of them allow us that federal bonus. There's no other law I can think of where if we pass it, we get millions of dollars right away just for passing it, even if we never, ever use the law, even if it sits on the shelf. Now, one key component of this is that whistleblowers are key. We know from the Petters incident here, now that's not a fraud on the state government as far as we know, but I think it's instructive, members, because remember there's this 42-year-old brave soul, Deanna Coleman was her name, who was the right hand of Tom Petters for years, and she literally walked off the street into the FBI office in a pang of conscience and spilled the beans. The FBI had no clue, no law enforcement had any clue about this Petters Ponzi scheme, and that I think is instructive about the importance of whistleblowers. Government agencies very often are overmatched when it comes to intentional fraud. There are smart people out there figuring out ways to scam the taxpayers, and it happens all the time. And they have more resources, and they are more clever very often than the government. And it takes an insider. It takes an insider to come forward very often and expose this stuff. And so without further ado, I'd like to introduce Neil Thompson. He's one of those insiders. And you may have read about him or seen him on CNN or other media outlets, but I'll have him introduce himself.
Thank you, Mr. Steinman. can you get them to do it in a few minutes, hopefully?
I hope you will.
Go ahead, introduce
yourself. I'll try and be brief. My name is Neil Thompson, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Thompson, go ahead.
I want to give this committee my perspective of a whistleblower law here in Minnesota. I'm a whistleblower, and I spent 3.5 years of my life helping the state of Minnesota and the federal government recover taxpayers' money. I'm an individual that you saw on CNN or in the Star and Tribune, and along with my colleague Dan Burantz, we turned in Walgreens for defrauding Medicaid. I've been a pharmacist for 31 years, first working for my father in a neighborhood pharmacy, later owning that pharmacy, and then later in my career working for some of the larger chain pharmacies here in Minnesota. And I can confidently tell this committee that even though you have seen large fraud awards on the news, you haven't seen anything yet. We have only seen the tip of the iceberg in healthcare fraud. People that know me have heard me saying for the last 15 years that healthcare fraud and fraud in the pharmacy industry specifically is probably the most corrupt industry in the United States today.
It's also the reason why I went to law school back in 1999. I don't like to admit that I went from the top of the Gallup poll in prestige down to the bottom by becoming a lawyer. But fraud by its very nature is covered up. It's hidden. And in my case, even when I told my supervisors and bosses, they said, don't worry about it. It's being taken care of. Corporate headquarters oversees that. You don't have to worry about that. It takes people like whistleblowers like myself to work on the insides of these companies to see things going on, to expose these things. In fact, the fraud that I uncovered, it took several meetings with the government officials and an expert in pharmacy billing to explain it to them. This isn't something that any government, no matter how well you fund it or how well you put people into the government, they would have never discovered this stuff. It takes somebody that's on the inside to be able to see it. But you'll never see these frauds, you'll never see these big awards that if you don't protect the whistleblowers and you don't incentivize them some way. And I say protect because you have to understand that when you're a whistleblower and you turn in your employer, that's a career-ending event. Now, I've done a lot of different things in my life. I'm married. I have four wonderful children. I went to the University of Minnesota Pharmacy School. I've worked in many different areas of pharmacy. I've worked in long-term care, nursing homes. I've worked in the PBM industry, retail pharmacy. I ran my own neighborhood pharmacy. I was robbed 8 times at gunpoint in that pharmacy. But nothing will prepare you for the stress that you undergo when you turn in your employer for a whistleblower case. For 3.5 years, I walked into the employer knowing full well that I had sued them. I had caused the FBI to appear at 12 of my bosses' houses at Sunday night to be interviewed about this welfare fraud. I knew that once they found out, they would pay millions of dollars over back to the government. I knew that I probably would never, ever work in the pharmacy industry again. Very few whistleblowers stay in that profession that they're in, and very few of them can even find another job in the same profession that they're in. And particularly with healthcare fraud, these are high-paying professions, and to ask somebody to turn somebody in for Medicaid fraud and end their career and end that profession is a drastic thing to ask them to do. So we have to protect them, we have to protect their jobs, we have to provide incentives for them to do this, otherwise they're simply not going to turn it in. Senator Grassley said that over 80% of all False Claims Acts are turned in by whistleblowers. You're never going to uncover some of this stuff unless you incentivize and protect the whistleblowers. I think this law does a lot of things to eradicate fraud in the Medicaid and the public reimbursement system. And I would wish that you would support whistleblowers and you would provide the incentives for them to bring this fraud to your attention.
Representative Simon, I think that...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like a chance just at the end, if I could.
Yes.
60 seconds.
Well, there'll be questions on that. Are there any opponents to this? If there's any opposition, would you get together and have maybe 2 people presented or something like that? Do you want to step forward?
Good morning, and thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Would you introduce yourself?
Yes. My name is Therese Goldsmith. I'm a partner with the law firm of Hogan and Hartson, which has offices in Washington, D.C. and a number of other cities in the United States.
Okay, and Ms.
Mr. Chair, my name is Carrie Thurlow. I'm the Vice President of Advocacy for Aging Services of Minnesota, and I'm here testifying on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative.
Okay, and Mr. Hesse's going to testify?
Mr. Chair, yes, I'm advocacy with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce.
Okay, we'll try and get you to work together and do about 10 minutes as they did. So, Ms. Goldsmith, are you first? Okay.
I'm pleased to be. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. At first blush, the 10% bonus incentive under the Deficit Reduction Act
described by Representative Simon, seems like a win for the state of Minnesota if Minnesota enacts a state quitam statute, a state false claims act statute with a quitam provision. But the analysis, that first blush analysis, fails to take into account several critical factors that in the end show that the legislation not only will not benefit the state's Medicaid program or the state of Minnesota, but in fact will have a net negative impact on the state treasury. And I'd like to briefly make 4 points that I think illustrate that argument. First, as I think the previous testimony by the pharmacist who acted as a whistleblower indicated, the federal and private whistleblowers already are using the Federal False Claims Act as an effective weapon to protect the federal health care programs and state Medicaid programs. When allegations concerning the submission of a false or fraudulent claim involve the Minnesota Medicaid program, Minnesota already benefits through the participation of its Medicaid Fraud Control Unit in settlements of those actions, generally calculated based on double damages to the Minnesota Medicaid program. So point one is, as was made clear in prior testimony, actions brought under the Federal False Claims Act already blow the whistle on alleged seek to defraud the Minnesota Medicaid program. Second point, and a very important one, is the object of quitam legislation, as was previously testified, is to encourage whistleblowers, also known as relators, to come forward to expose schemes to defraud the government, in this case the state of Minnesota, by rewarding them with a bounty to do so. In cases brought under the Federal False Claims Act, that bounty is measured as a percentage of the federal government's contribution to the state Medicaid program and paid out of the federal government's recovery. With the enactment of a state quitam statute, the quitam relator's share of the proceeds of any recovery by settlement or through litigation would be calculated not only on the federal government's contribution to or recovery from the proceeding, but also from the state's recovery. So that 10% DRA bonus that the state would obtain by enacting a whistleblower statute would be more than eaten up by, on average, a 20% whistleblower share of the recovery that the state would obtain under if the state enacted a quitam whistleblower statute. The way we've seen these things happen in other states that have enacted state quitam statutes to supplement the federal quitam statute is not that schemes to defraud the Medicaid program that are limited to the state level, new schemes, are brought forward by whistleblowers, but rather actions that already have been filed under the Federal False Claims Act are amended to add a count under the state quitam statute. So you have a claim filed in federal court in any jurisdiction that the relators choose, and as states enact quitam statutes, the relator amends the complaint to add a count under the applicable state quitam statutes, and then when those cases are resolved, the relator gets, on average, 20% share from the federal proceeds as well as from every state who has enacted a quitam statute. If I may, I'd like to, my partner, Jonathan Diesenhaus, has submitted to Representative Simon a letter with an attachment and a table. I recognize time is short, but there is a table that I think illustrates this net loss to the state of Minnesota by enacting a quitam statute. Mr. Chair, if I may, could I distribute that letter?
Yes, you can. No.
I won't spend a lot of time talking about it, but I think attachment A, which is the only attachment to this letter, illustrates the point that enactment of a quitam statute at the state level does not bring to light new schemes that have not already been identified under the federal false by whistleblowers or the federal government under the Federal False Claims Act, and B, requires the state to pay over on average 20% of its recovery under that statute.
Ms. Goldsmith, if your other two are going to testify, they've only got about 3 minutes left. You've used up almost...
They only have 3 minutes?
You've used up most of the time. So
I apologize. Let me make one final point, and thank you for your indulgence by name, Mr. Chair. And that is that a state pre-temp statute that is going to qualify for the BPA 10% bonus must be approved by the federal government. There are numerous inconsistencies in the House File 8 when you compare the language of that statute as proposed to the language of the Federal False Claims Act. And this session, the United States Congress, is considering substantial amendments to the Federal False Claims Act, which would require states who have an active False Claims Act that must comport with the federal act to amend that any statutes that are in place.
Ms. Thurlow?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, my name is Carrie Thurlow. I'm the Vice President of Advocacy for Aging Services of Minnesota. I'm appearing today on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative, which is a collaboration between Aging Services of Minnesota and Care Providers of Minnesota. Together, the two organizations represent virtually every nursing home in the state of Minnesota, in addition to providers of assisted living, independent senior living, home care, basically the continuum of older adult services. The previous testifier covered much of what I was going to say, and in the interest of brevity, we've also reduced many of our comments and concerns to a letter. By full disclosure, we did meet and express many of these concerns with Representative Simon yesterday and look forward to continuing the discussion. I will make one additional point that hasn't been raised. We would say that we believe that the passage of this law is unnecessary for many of the reasons that have already been articulated. But in addition, the Department of Human Services just underwent additional rulemaking that completed in July that their surveillance and integrity review section refined the definition of abusive claims to include billing for services that were outside the scope of the vendor's license, or in the case of a vendor that is not required to hold a license, billing by such a vendor for services that the vendor is not authorized to provide under applicable regulatory agency requirements. So in addition to the federal protection that has already been more than aptly outlined, the Department of Human Services is working through rulemaking to also address and refine their enforcement of Medicaid fraud issues. Mr. Chair, I would also point out that under the federal requirements, providers under the Medicaid entitlement program are required to train employees about the Federal False Claims Act. Currently, the Department of Human Services does enforce, and as the previous testifier already indicated, the Federal False Claims Act does provide incentives for whistleblowers to come forward. For those reasons, Mr. Chair, and with your permission, we'd like to distribute the letter that more clearly articulates our concerns, and would be happy to answer any questions at this time as well.
You can distribute it, but Mr. Hesse, you're down to a minute.
All right. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, for the record, my name is Tom Hesse. I'm with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. The Minnesota Chamber also opposes House File 8, and we do agree with the concerns that have been expressed by the other testifiers. But let me just bring up a few points for you to concentrate on. First, the bill does not require any specific intent to defraud, and that we think is something that should be corrected. Second, the Attorney General does not have to prove actual damages to move forward with a case. Third, I think the attorney fee section seems to have some bad incentives in it. If the Attorney General handles the litigation for a person, and the person can still be awarded attorney fees even though they did not incur expenses, and that in that case, it's if the AG prevails. And if the AG loses a case, it doesn't face the same consequences as a person who loses when the action was frivolous or brought for harassment. The person has to pay attorney's fees in those situations. The AG does not, and that does not seem to be fair. And it also appears that there is a retroactive application of this statute, since there's no clear effective date in the legislation. There are other concerns, but with respect to the time, I'll just cut it off there.
Thank you, Mr. Hesse. You're the only one so far that kept your time limits. Okay, would maybe we can get some chairs up there, and Mr. Representative Simon and his witness can come up, and the others maybe can stay handy so they can answer. Ms. Goldsmith, Thurlow, and Mr. Hesse, could you be handy down here so that we can have cross
questions here. Could you come down closer? And I represent, I'll get you in just a second. let's see. Maybe a couple could come up further. Okay, Representative Holburn, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, I think at the very least, if you would ask for a show of hands of people in the audience that also wanted to testify against this, that haven't been able to. I know there's groups that have flown people in from out of state.
People have flown in from where? All over, Mr. Chair.
And Mr. Chair, I know that you want to move things along here, and I understand that, but this is a pretty complex issue with a lot of people that have interest in it, and when we send bills out of here without having a full hearing of people's concerns, and it goes on to other committees, this is the only place where you can deal with the civil issues, and I don't know if there's a huge hurry, but, you know, I mean, I understand the tension between trying to get things done, but if we don't do things right in this committee, there's no other place along the line where they deal with these issues or should deal with them. And so I don't know if Representative Simon, is there some kind of rush to move this through or...
Representative Holbert, it does go to Commerce afterwards. Is there, who is from out of, what does out of town mean? I've had people say Robbinsdale was out of town. Do you want to come up? Or you're already testified. Okay. I think we can go ahead. Do you have a question?
Could I see a show of hands how many people were here to testify in opposition to the bill that haven't had an opportunity?
Well, okay. We'll give you each a minute then if you want to come up real quickly. I think that Ms. Goldsmith laid out a lot of the issues and Ms. Thurlow as well as Mr. Heffey. So repetition of same issues is not necessarily. Go ahead and introduce yourself.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Catherine Knitt and I represent the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. The Council of Health Plans is a trade association that represents Minnesota's 8 nonprofit health plans. I do have a handout for the committee listing our concerns about the bill. We are supportive of the intent of this bill to eliminate fraud and abuse. We agree with that intent. Health plans devote numerous resources and staff to identify, report, and report fraud and abuse, and we cooperate with the government in subsequent investigations. At the same time, however, we want to make sure, here's the handout, we want to make sure the passage of House File 8 does not create different and competing and confusing standards at both the state and federal level. So we're just looking for some consistency. We met with Senate with Representative Simon yesterday. He was very open to working with us, and we're very pleased about that. I just want to say, leave you with this point, that the bill is inconsistent with federal law, and we don't believe that the state law needs to be different from the federal law. So with that, I'll pass it on to the next testifier.
Mr. Feinwax, do you have anything brand new for us?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, only that I represent the Minnesota Hospital Association. I agree with what the previous witnesses have said, and I simply would add that this is not as simple as it appears. There's more here than the concept of who is for or against fraud. Nobody is for fraud. Healthcare systems are increasingly complex. I haven't the time or the luxury to explain to you how errors occur and their consequences, but adding this kind of complexity in a rush without thinking it through is exceedingly dangerous in a time when we are doing things to create exponential disincentives for people to avoid risk. And so on behalf of Minnesota Hospitals, I need to tell you that this thing needs a lot of work.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Mark Calder, the ULDA, with the Insurance Federation of Minnesota. We don't have anything extra to add other than our intent is to prevent abusive lawsuits, and that the official position of the Insurance Federation is opposed to the bill. No,
thank you. Okay, Representative Simon, you're back.
Thank you.
Do you want to make a couple of clarification or disagreements with what was said before we open it to questions?
I would. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
So much to respond to, so little time. First, let me say that I understand that the folks up here who testified against have good intentions, and they have clients, and those they are trying to zealously represent.
that are somehow scared about the implications here. I think that that fear is misplaced, and I think it's alarmist. There is already a False Claims Act on the federal level. There already is. So when the feds are cheated, they have this recourse, and we don't. So this idea that this is going to open up a new day of frivolous lawsuits is just absurd. It's absolutely absurd. We have a False Claims Act right now. Any disgruntled employee or anyone else could already run to the feds under the existing law. So that's not a real problem. All of the testifiers, as far as I saw, Mr. Chair and members, talked about the Medicaid aspect, or the medical aspect of the bill. But remember, this bill, like all False Claims Acts, applies to all contractors, whether it's roads, schools, computer equipment, etc. Next, as for the chart that I got in the letter 10 minutes before the hearing, what's really interesting about that chart, it's deceptively simple, is it assumes that it's an apples and apples comparison between the government knowing about these cases and going after them with the False Claims Act and the government knowing about these cases and going after them without the False Claims Act. Well, that presupposes that the government knows about them in the first place. The whole idea behind the first False Claims Act is that we'll incentivize whistleblowers, and as we've seen in other states, these are new cases that we otherwise would never have seen. So it's not apples to apples in that chart. Next, what the testifiers and the chart neglect to tell you is that under this statute, the state and the federal government can recover anywhere between 2 and 3 times their actual damages. How is it ever a loss for the state when we get more than 100% of our damages, let alone 2 or 3 times our damages? The chart doesn't include that basic information. We hope to have someone here from the Medicaid Fraud Unit of the Attorney General's office here today. She couldn't make it. I trust she'll be at future hearings, and she will tell you loudly and clearly that this is a huge benefit to the state of Minnesota, and that she and her division do not presently have the tools to go after all the Medicaid fraud that is out there. But I think members should keep in mind this is not a Medicaid fraud bill. This is a bill about all those who knowingly, and that is the key word, knowingly, not accidentally, not oops, not negligently, knowingly defraud the state of Minnesota and our constituents. As for the language being similar or not similar to the federal law basically tells us we shouldn't be too similar. The federal law says that only those states whose language is at least as effective in fighting fraud, at least as effective, will be considered for the 10% bonus. And in fact, the federal government has rejected several states who have passed False Claims Acts and said, nope, you don't get the 10% bonus because you're not strong enough. And so it's true that the civil penalties here are stronger and higher than the federal government. But the federal government has essentially commanded us to do that. Once people come forward to me with practical suggestions about amendment language they'd like to see, I'm all ears. As I told the two groups who met with me yesterday, that's the beginning, not an end. I'm happy always to meet with anyone. But simply baying at the moon and talking about how this is the end of the world, that's not good enough. It shouldn't be for this committee, and it's not for me. I'm happy to entertain any practical suggestions, but what I've heard so far is not practical. It's they're complaints without constructive alternatives.
I just also like to point out to the non-attorneys, for those of us who have practiced for 30 years, there's huge numbers of laws where we're similar to the federal, and we have different penalties. We cover different situations, and there's absolutely no problem. Every state does that. The only problem would be if there's a direct conflict on what you're supposed to do under the federal and this, and there is no such thing. Is that correct? There's no conflict?
No, there's no conflict. And Chair and members, just so you know, in terms of this idea that this needs a lot of work, this is a result of some, I'm not saying it's perfect or that it can't be made better, and that's why I'm entertaining constructive solutions here, actual amendment language, not just concepts. But, you know, I think, you know, we worked painstakingly on this for quite a while, worked with Mark Shepard of House Research, did an extensive analysis of what the federal government has required of states who seek the 10% bonus, why the federal government rejected certain states in the past who had passed False Claims Act and didn't get the 10% bonus. So I'm not saying we made every call correctly, but I am saying this really was the result of a long, thoughtful, and very painstaking process. I'm happy to entertain particular amendment language, but I haven't seen any.
We have Representative Horton.
Mr. Chair, just to the comments made by the witness, I don't think we're in a hurry, and I don't think we're failing to think it through. Representative Simon, how many states have a law like this?
21.
Finished? Okay. Representative Westrom.
Mr. Chair, concerned as Representative Holberg, this seems to be probably a two-hearing type bill or longer. Representative Simon, my concern is that up front it sounds great to let's rid out fraud, and I don't think there's anybody opposed to that. In fact, that's what we need to happen. There's an inherent tension, of course. As we grow government programs, there's a, as things get bigger, government or corporations, businesses, there's always a bigger problem of having oversight directly, which begs for maybe smaller government and smaller businesses in this country rather than the big stuff if it's such a problem. But the concern I've got is the last several years, we seem to always dump a little more money into the tax department when we get short, because we're going to go after all these bad guys and gals that are defrauding the government of their taxes. If you recall back in 1994 or 95, I think it was 94, there were some really attention-getting, compelling hearings to overhaul the IRS because they became so thuggish and really became just an agency of shakedown the public. Right or wrong, they finally will throw their hands up because they don't have the resources to fight a big government. I would challenge your argument that says many of these people have more resources than the government. The opposite is usually true, and they are also funding the government, who has the attorneys at the taxpayers' expense. How do we strike this balance? Because I am continuing to get more and more, and I just got a call yesterday from another contractor. We passed a 2% law in the tax bill last year that most of us, I would guess, don't even know was in there, but he's a general contractor, and now he's required to hold back 2% of the payments to the subcontractor so they aren't, quote, defrauding the government of their taxes. Now, he gets to do all that paperwork. He is absolutely hostile about this. How do we strike the balance of not becoming just a shakedown agency or a government of shaking down the taxpayers, right or wrong? Second comment, in relates to the question, is I had this conversation with an attorney up in western Minnesota, a Democrat, by the way, works with one of the hospitals, and he is making comments to me about how they are spending so much time to protect and prove that they are not committing fraud to the federal government that he said it is just unbelievable the amount of time they're spending on salaries just to do this, to prove their innocence. How do we find that balance here? Because I think we're...
Representative Simon? Thank you. Representative Weston, thanks for the question, and it's a very fair question. I would respond in three ways. First, members, as with the Federal Act, income taxes are exempt. So this is not incentivizing people to become revenue agents or IRS agents. So taxes are exempt. Tax fraud is completely exempt because that's a whole different silo. Secondly, I would argue, and you make the case about growing government, and I would say that this relieves the burden of government because it incentivizes private people in private industry to do a lot of the investigative work that we would otherwise want the BCA or the Hennepin County Attorney's Office or the AG's office doing. They will root out this fraud. We're not going to be sending agents in to discover fraud. So it comes from an organic level at the employer level, folks like Mr. Thompson who witnessed this stuff. So I would argue it actually relieves pressure and burdens and would arguably shrink the government, I guess, at the margins, you might say, because these are private folks doing the gumshoe work. And finally, I would say, in terms of frivolous lawsuits, and that's a very fair point, Section 12 of the bill allows that if an individual goes ahead with a lawsuit and the Attorney General's office decides not to intervene and the individual loses, that is, the defendant wins, then the individual plaintiff can be assessed the defendant's attorney's fees, the reasonable attorney's fees. That might be a lot of money. I mean, that might be in the hundreds of thousands of dollars that individual, if they go ahead with a frivolous claim, are assessed. That's in Section 12 of the bill. So that's how I've at least tried to accommodate that balance. But that's a fair question.
Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Simon, Just from a practicality standpoint, I understand, you know, we were given this chart and also suggesting that this would actually cost the state of Minnesota over $2 million per year. And as you said, you don't feel that this is an apples-to-apples comparison and understand the time constraints, but would it be possible for you and your research team to put together a table that actually would, in your opinion, be an apples-to-apples comparison so that we could actually see what you believe is the revenue production from this?
Representative Simon. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Kelly. I will try to do something like that or to quantify what the gains would be. I don't know if I can do it in table form. I just saw this letter 10 minutes before the hearing. I'll note that the other letter handed out to the committee, I wasn't even given the courtesy of seeing it and still haven't seen it. So I would say to the folks, Ms. Thurlow and others, that's really getting off on the wrong foot. So I'd like to see these letters from now on with more than 10 minutes notice. But I will do my best. We had hoped to have someone from the Attorney General's office here who couldn't make it this morning to quantify at least her good faith judgment about what the net gains would be to Minnesota. But that too is a fair question.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I just have a question regarding the definition of reckless disregard.
Mm-hmm.
And to me that almost sounds like, you know, you said negligence wouldn't apply here, but that almost sounds like there's a little bit of probably innocence in that term.
Representative Simon, did you?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Scott, that's an interesting question. Reckless disregard, you know, it's a concept that's been around for a long time. There's a ton of case law on it. I'd be happy to try to provide some cases, some Minnesota cases, about what that means in other contexts. You know, it's a fairly common kind of legal standard, the knowingly standard, the reckless disregard. And I'm sure there are cases out there, I can't think of any right now, that illustrate, you know, what that really means. And maybe there are even other committee members who know that. So I'll try to come up with an illustration, but that's a pretty common term.
Representative Simon, I see it all the time in law, but I can't remember what cases I've actually said. Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, Representative Simon, I just appealed to you from some of the comments that Representative Holberg had. We've got some people who would still like to testify on this bill. It seems that there's a push to move this through quicker than really a good and fair hearing for the bill would provide. I think that the process that we saw with the Green Acres legislation last year and the a lack of the grassroots hearing process contributed to now a law that we have that largely is not acceptable to Minnesotans. And I've also am aware of the work that that Representative Pulaski's committee did to look at ways to have our legislature, our House especially, do a better job of moving the bills through in ways that make sense. One of those recommendations is outlined in a letter from the Speaker to the committee chairs. That somebody gave me a copy of a letter here. She said, the Speaker says in the last bullet, committee should take the time necessary to do this work, even if it means holding bills over for multiple hearings. Mr. Chair and Representative Simon, I think we need to look for another hearing on this, if that's workable for you.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members and Representative Simon. I found some time this summer to listen to the opposition and. You know, one of the big things that I heard coming from the minority leader was fraud in government and welfare and Medicaid and a variety of other places. Do you believe that this would alleviate Representative Seifert's concerns about fraud and help address that?
Representative Simon?
Thank you, Representative Mahoney. Yes, I think that this is a very helpful anti-fraud tool. Very helpful.
Thank you.
And that to the tune of many millions of dollars at least. We'll come out on top.
And just very briefly to Representative Drazkowski, we don't need to hear the same thing. That's why I asked Mr. Feinlock, who I've known for a long time, whether he had something new, and he said no. He wanted to make sure that we were aware that his association was on the opposition. Is there any other witnesses or questions, I mean? We're going to vote pretty quickly. Representative Holberg has not had a question yet.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Simon. I really wish we'd have the opportunity to get our questions answered, and Representative Mahoney, we don't want fraud to occur in government, but we also don't want to pass a bill out of the Civil Law Committee that has unintended consequences or that we haven't had all the answers to our questions provided to us. Looking at the yellow handout here, and it talks about the key differences between state law and federal law. There's a number of bullet points there, but the ones that I am most concerned about, and in the interest of time I'd like you to address, would be the first bullet and then the retroactive application of the act.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and mindful of everyone else's time. Yes, I did receive this yesterday, which I appreciated, giving you some advance notice on it. As to the first bullet point, it's deceptively simple. It says, wow, look at this. The Attorney General can proceed with no regard to actual damages. That sounds crazy, but it's not crazy. It's like the shoplifting analogy. So if someone sets off a sensor and they're walking out of the store with a bunch of iPods, they got caught, right? So should they just be able to walk free? No, the False Claims Act pertains not only to successful fraud, but to those who have actually perpetrated the fraud of submitting the false claim. That in itself is fraud. So that's absolutely a true statement, that it's not in regard to actual damages. You can go ahead and go after folks who submit false claims, even if they're later discovered. So that is true.
Okay, and if I might, the retroactive application of the act, or how far back? I see there's a 10-year standard in here, but when does this become effective? And for acts perpetrated, I mean, what's
right.
The look
but
back? Or
I don't believe that the look back is 10 years. I think that's going back too far. But yeah, I don't know the actual applicable statute of limitations. But it's only retroactive in the sense that if there's fraud going on today, or if there was fraud going on yesterday, we want to recover the money from those who are knowingly defrauding us. So. To that extent, it's retroactive, but I don't know why there should be a grace period until July 1st and August 1st, whenever this would become enacted, why there ought to be a grace period for people who are today, on January 21st, knowingly defrauding our constituents.
Well, Representative Simon, I don't think we normally have statute of limitations on going back on at least for a while. I mean, we have statute of limitations, but we don't have no retroactivity on fraud claims against the government normally.
And, Mr. Chair, I guess I'm looking at the bill summary of Section 11, and it talks about that you have to be brought within 3 years of the date of discovery or within 6 years after the activity occurred, not more than 10 years after the violation occurred. So I'm just trying to get a handle on it. I'm not saying it's right or wrong,
yeah.
But again, I'd like to understand what we have in front of us and what the ramifications are.
I would say that the way it is, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, it's a 6-year statute of limitations, a 10-year statute of repose. So the person can't bring an action for anything that happened less than 6 years later, prior, and the entire lawsuit can't be brought greater than 10 years after the fraud. I think that's okay. I think I said that right.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you, Representative Holberg. Then we're going to vote. We're over 10 minutes now. So all in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no.
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 No, it carries. Meeting's adjourned.